question whether we deserve it, or fear that now something bad is bound to happen. No sooner do we take a bite of our favorite flavor of ice cream than we start calculating how much more we can eat without feeling too guilty or piling on the pounds. We stand in a beautiful landscape and worry because we have run out of film, or start thinking we really should move to the country. When we are meditating, we experience a delicious stretch of tranquility and peace, and then immediately begin wondering how to keep it going. Our enjoyment is tainted by anxiety about keeping what we have and our compulsion to reach out and get more. Unfolding the wings of acceptance. When we are caught in the trance of unworthiness, we do not clearly recognize what is happening inside us, nor do we feel kind. Our view of who we are is contorted and narrowed, and our heart feels hardened against life. As we lean into the experience of the moment, releasing our stories and gently holding our pain or desire, radical acceptance begins to unfold. The two parts of genuine acceptance, seeing clearly and holding our experience with compassion, are as interdependent as the two wings of a great bird. Together, they enable us to fly and be free. The wing of clear seeing is often described in Buddhist practice as mindfulness. This is the quality of awareness that recognizes exactly what is happening in our moment-to-moment experience. When we are mindful of fear, for instance, we are aware that our thoughts are racing, that our body feels tight and shaky, that we feel compelled to flee, and we recognize all this without trying to manage our experience in any way, without pulling away. Our attentive presence is unconditional and open. We are willing to be with whatever arises, even if we wish the pain would end or that we could be doing something else. That wish and that thought become part of what we are accepting. Because we are not tampering with our experience, mindfulness allows us to see life as it is. This recognition of the truth of our experience is intrinsic to radical acceptance. We can't honestly accept an experience unless we see clearly what we are accepting. The second wing of radical acceptance, compassion, is our capacity to relate in a tender and sympathetic way to what we perceive. Instead of resisting our feelings of fear or grief, we embrace our pain with the kindness of a mother holding her child. Rather than judging or indulging our desire for attention or chocolate or sex, we regard our grasping with gentleness and care. Compassion honors our experience. It allows us to be intimate with the life of this moment as it is. Compassion makes our acceptance wholehearted and complete. The two wings of clear seeing and compassion are inseparable. Both are essential in liberating us from the trance. They work together, mutually reinforcing each other. If we are rejected by someone we love, the trance of unworthiness may ensnare us in obsessive thinking, blaming the one who hurt us, and at the same time, believing that we were jilted because we are defective. We may feel caught in a relentless swing between explosive anger and wrenching grief and shame. The two wings of radical acceptance free us from this swirling vortex of reaction. They help us find the balance and clarity that can guide us in choosing what we say or do. If we were to bring only the wing of mindfulness to our process of radical acceptance, we might be clearly aware of the aching in our heart, the flush of rage in our face. We might clearly see the stories we are telling ourselves, that we are a victim, that we will always be alone and without love. But we might also compound our suffering by feeling angry with ourselves for getting into the situation in the first place. This is where the wing of compassion joins with mindfulness to create a genuinely healing presence. Instead of pushing away or judging our anger or despondency, compassion enables us to be softly and kindly present with our open wounds. In the same way, Mindfulness balances compassion. If our heartfelt caring begins to bleed over into self-pity, giving rise to another storyline, we tried so hard but didn't get what we so dearly wanted. Mindfulness enables us to see the trap we're falling into. Both wings together help us remain in the experience of the moment, just as it is. When we do this, something begins to happen. We feel freer, options open before us. We see with more clarity how we want to proceed. Radical acceptance helps us to heal and move on, free from unconscious habits of self-hatred and blame. While the ground of radical acceptance is our moment-to-moment experience, we can bring the same clear and kind attention to the patterns of thoughts and feelings, behaviors and events that shape our life experience. We become more aware of the intentions that motivate our behavior. We also become aware of the consequences of our actions, as they affect both ourselves and others. In Buddhist psychology, including this larger view in an accepting awareness is called clear comprehension. Suppose that we become aware that we are regularly losing our temper and treating our children in a disrespectful, disparaging way. We can begin examining our intentions, opening with acceptance to the thoughts and feelings that arise as we do so. Perhaps we realize that we want to push our children away because we feel too stressed to handle their needs. I'm sinking and trying to save my own life. Along with this thought, we might feel a tightness in our belly that spreads like a wave and grips at our throat. We might also look and see the actual effect of our behavior on our children. Have they withdrawn from us? As we notice that our children are becoming secretive and fearful around us, we might feel in our chest a rising sense of sorrow. We also notice the effect our angry behavior has on our own body and mind. How isolated or bad we feel after we impulsively lash out. The larger view offered by clear comprehension invariably leads us back to our deepest intention. We don't want to suffer or cause suffering. We might recognize that more than anything, we want our children to know how much we love them. This longing, too, is met with clear seeing and kindness. In this way, by regarding the entire context of our circumstances with radical acceptance, we become increasingly able to align our actions with our heart. Since non-acceptance is the very nature of the trance, we might wonder how, when we feel most stuck, we take the first step toward radical acceptance. It can give us confidence to remember that the Buddha nature that is our essence remains intact no matter how lost we may be. The very nature of our awareness is to know what is happening. The very nature of our heart is to care. Like a boundless sea, we have the capacity to embrace the waves of life as they move through us. Even when the sea is stirred up by the winds of self-doubt, we can find our way home. We can discover, in the midst of the waves, our spacious and wakeful awareness. We lay the foundations of radical acceptance by recognizing when we are caught in the habit of judging, resisting, and grasping, and how we constantly try to control our levels of pain and pleasure. We lay the foundations of radical acceptance by seeing how we create suffering when we turn harshly against ourselves, and by remembering our intention to love life. As we let go of our stories of what is wrong with us, we begin to touch what is actually happening with a clear and kind attention. We release our plans or fantasies and arrive open-handed in the experience of this moment. Whether we feel pleasure or pain, the wings of acceptance allow us to honor and cherish this ever-changing life as it is. Facing the anguish of trance. When I first started practicing yoga and meditation, I didn't realize that acceptance was at the heart of spiritual life. I was only partly aware of how my feelings of never being good enough were keeping me from the peace and freedom I longed for. In the end, it took an experience that broke me apart emotionally to awaken from the habits and conditioning of years. Although the outer circumstances of my personal story were unusual, many people have told me they recognize the inner drama as their own. By the time I was in my late 20s, I had lived for 8 years in the spiritual community I joined after college. In addition to teaching regular classes in yoga and meditation, I was going to school to get a doctorate in clinical psychology and seeing clients in a full-time counseling practice. This meant I was often stressfully stretched between my life in the outside world and life in the ashram. I was sometimes chastised by my teacher for not giving more energy to the community, and I often felt guilty that I was spread so thin. But I valued both worlds and couldn't imagine giving up either. At the suggestion of our teacher, I had married a man from our spiritual community several years before. From our first days together, we longed to have a child. Although my life was pulled in so many directions, when I finally got pregnant, we were thrilled that our dream was coming true. We agreed that it would be a good time for me to take a month off from my therapy practice for some rest and spiritual nourishment. I decided to spend the time at a yoga and meditation retreat being led by our teacher in the desert of Southern California. 2 weeks into the retreat, I started bleeding heavily. My friends took me to a nearby hospital where my dream of motherhood ended in miscarriage. I was filled with grief over losing the baby. As I lay in the hospital bed, I struggled to make sense of what had gone wrong. Could the strenuous yoga and intense summer heat have been too much for me? When I got back to our retreat site, I left a phone message for my teacher telling him what had happened and mentioning my concerns. I didn't hear back from him. I spent the next 2 days in bed, recovering, grieving, praying. On the third day, I decided to attend the daily gathering where the teacher would be giving a talk. I felt I could use the inspiration, and I knew I would feel comforted being with my spiritual family. It was a hot desert evening, and several hundred of us sat under a huge open tent, quietly meditating, waiting for our teacher to arrive. When we saw his car pull up, we all stood and began chanting a song of devotion. Trailed by his entourage of robed yogis, he entered the tent and settled in front on cushions that matched the orange and pink of the setting sun. Our chant ended, and we sat down, watching quietly as he ate a cookie and some grapes from a carefully prepared tray of food. His gaze swept the sea of upturned faces, each eagerly awaiting his inspiration. With a sudden start, I realized he was staring directly at me. Breaking the silence, he called out my name, the Sanskrit name he had given me years before when I committed myself to following his teachings. The sound of his voice rang in my ears as he asked me to stand up. Sometimes in such gatherings, he would publicly address a particular student, so I thought he might be checking to see how I was doing. Instead, without any prelude, he declared in a harsh tone that I had caused my baby's death by being so professionally ambitious and ego-centered. I felt as if I had been kicked in the stomach. The shock of pain twisted my insides. I stood frozen and numb as he continued, telling me in crude language that I had been willing to have sex, but did not really want a child. This must be a bad dream. Certainly he had criticized me privately for my life outside the ashram, but never viciously, never with such rage and contempt. I sat down, burning with shame. While my doubts about him had grown over the past few years, my trust was now fully betrayed. A raw and deep hole of pain began to swallow up everything in me. Trembling, I listened without comprehension as his voice droned on somewhere in the background. When the talk was over and his car drove off, several friends embraced me, awkwardly searching for the right words. I could see the confusion in their eyes. His teaching must have been given in this way to serve a spiritual purpose. Our teacher couldn't be wrong. Yet something didn't seem right. I was grateful for their comfort, but mostly I just wanted to disappear. Years before, I had read a story about a young injured soldier who, after returning from battle, was rumored to be a traitor and banished from his village. He could feel everyone watching him, even pitying him, as he limped away with his small bag of clothes and food. That's what I felt like now. Humiliated and unreachable, I tried to avoid the eyes of fellow yogis as I made my way to the edge of the crowd. I felt as if all 150 of them either sat in judgment or pitied me. I desperately wanted to be alone. Feeling this wretched, how could I be with anyone? Through tears, I found my way to a small sanctuary nestled in a circle of Joshua trees. Sitting on the hard, bare floor, I sobbed aloud for hours. How could this have happened? My baby was gone and my teacher had condemned me. Was he right? My whole body told me he was wrong about the baby. But what was it about me that made him lash out so angrily when I was clearly so vulnerable? Maybe he had been offended by the phone message I left and believed I was challenging the wisdom of his program and teachings. Maybe he knew I harbored some doubts about him, that I didn't fully trust him. But why so venomous, so hateful? Was I really as bad as he said? My heart breaking with fear and grief, I felt severed from my world and estranged from my own being. Was I on the right spiritual path? How could I continue to belong to a community so unquestioningly devoted to such a teacher? What would happen to my marriage if I could no longer follow this path? Could I bear to lose my spiritual family, a whole way of life, by leaving? As the world closed in around me, an old and familiar despair took hold. Not only had his words flung me into a pit of my own ugliness, now the voices inside me were confirming that I was fundamentally flawed. For as long as I could remember, I had been trying to prove my worth. I remembered myself as a teenager, debating with my lawyer father at the dinner table, feeling so proud and relieved when he was impressed by a persuasive argument. My heart sank as I recalled how I had played out this same routine with my teachers or others in authority. When images of my mother arose, her lying in bed reading a mystery novel, gin and tonic by her side, I felt flooded by memories of her struggle with depression and anxiety. Maybe my compulsion to appear strong and together was a way of avoiding those same currents in myself. Was I even a caring person? Maybe helping clients or friends was merely a way of getting appreciation or recognition. All my striving, to get my doctorate, to be a good yogi, to be good, all fit into this story of an insecure and defective person. Nothing about me felt pure or trustworthy. In anguish and desperation, I reached out as I had many times before to the presence I call the Beloved. This unconditionally loving and wakeful awareness had always been a refuge for me. As I whispered Beloved and felt my yearning to belong to this loving awareness, something began to happen. It was subtle at first, just a feeling that I wasn't so lost and alone. Instead of being entirely immersed in a cauldron of suffering, I was beginning to sense an openness and tenderness within and around me. My world was becoming more spacious. Through the long hours of the night, I moved between the pain of my wounds and this growing openness. Each time one of those condemning voices tried to take over, when I could remember that caring presence, I found I could hear the judgments without believing them. When stories arose of times when I had acted selfishly or pretended to be something I wasn't, I could release the thoughts and simply feel the aching bruise in my heart. As I opened to pain without resisting it, everything in my experience softened and became more fluid. In my mind, a new voice arose. I want to accept myself completely, even if I am as flawed as my teacher claimed, even if my striving and insecurity meant I was caught up in my ego. I wanted to hold myself warmly, honor myself, not condemn myself. Even if I was selfish and critical, I wanted to accept those aspects of myself unconditionally. I wanted to stop the ceaseless monitoring and criticizing. I found myself praying, "May I love and accept myself just as I am." I began to feel as if I were gently cradling myself. Every wave of life moving through me belonged and was acceptable. Even the voice of fear, the one that told me something is wrong with me, was acceptable and could not taint this deep and genuine caring. The suffering that opens us to radical acceptance. My mother was one of several alumni elected on the basis of life achievement to address a class of graduating seniors at Barnard College. One day, just before her 75th birthday, she received a call from the student assigned to interview her. The young reporter began by complimenting my mother for her work in heading the large nonprofit organization that was doing so much to serve people suffering from alcoholism. When she asked how I got into this fascinating field, my mother later wryly commented to me, "I said to this earnest undergrad, 'Barbara dear, I drank my way in.'" During my childhood, my mother had used alcohol to numb her emotional pain. Increasingly anxious and miserable, she found meaning and purpose only in her love for her family. Yet by the time I was 16, she could no longer avoid the fact that those of us closest to her were in distress over her drinking. None of her well-worn modes of denial, of being secretive or trying to please others, worked anymore. Her life was fully out of control. My mother was hitting bottom. The 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, AA, talks about hitting bottom as the turning point where genuine recovery from addiction becomes possible. With the support of AA, my mother was able to acknowledge and respond to her disease. By facing her suffering directly, by accepting and opening to her insecurity and shame, she reconnected with meaning in her life. Through her years of recovery, she began to move beyond her identity as that little girl who was unreal and undeserving of attention. She learned that belonging didn't depend on her efforts to please others. Now her work and way of relating to others arise from a deep and genuine well of caring. But to awaken from her trance, my mother had to stop running and accept her pain. The poet Rumi saw clearly the relationship between our wounds and our awakening. He counseled, "Don't turn away. Keep your gaze on the bandaged place. That's where the light enters you." When we look directly at the bandaged place without denying or avoiding it, we become tender toward our human vulnerability. Our attention allows the light of wisdom and compassion to enter. In this way, times of great suffering can become times of profound spiritual insight and opening. Nearly all of us have faced seasons in our life where everything seemed to be falling apart. At these times, all the beliefs upon which we based our life are torn from their moorings. We thought we understood how to live life, but now we feel lost in a stormy sea. As the storm quiets, we begin to see our life with freshness and a striking clarity. Over the years, I've come to see my experience at the desert retreat less as a betrayal by my teacher than as a window into how much I had betrayed myself. In the face of his attack, my habitual defensive strategies crumbled and I hit bottom. While I was plunged into excruciating pain, it served to reveal the pain of unworthiness I had been living with for years. Fear of being a flawed person lay at the root of my trance, and I had sacrificed many moments over the years in trying to prove my worth. Like the tiger Mohini, I inhabited a self-made prison that stopped me from living fully. Radical acceptance of all my feelings and fears of imperfection was the only way I could free myself. By attending to the bandaged place, embracing the pain I had been running from, I began to trust myself and my life. Common misunderstandings about radical acceptance. The practice of radical acceptance runs at such cross currents to our culture of non-acceptance that it can be difficult to understand. It may sound as if I'm talking about resignation or self-indulgence or excusing bad behavior. I am practicing radical acceptance, so don't judge me for not taking responsibility at work or being unpleasant and insensitive at home. Because radical acceptance is such a powerful practice, I'd like to examine these areas of potential confusion in more detail. Radical acceptance is not resignation. The greatest misunderstanding about radical acceptance is that if we simply accept ourselves as we are, we will lose our motivation to change and grow. Acceptance can be misconstrued as an excuse for persisting in bad habits. That's just the way I am. Take it or leave it. Or we might want to change in positive ways, but conclude, I am the way I am, I'll never change anyway. Acceptance might suggest that we resign ourselves to being exactly as we are, which often enough means not good enough. However, as psychologist Carl Rogers' seminal insight proclaims, the curious paradox is that when I accept myself just as I am, then I can change. Our deepest nature is to awaken and flower. I have discovered again and again that bringing radical acceptance to any part of our experience is the fundamental shift that opens the way to genuine, lasting change. This book offers many examples of how such change unfolds when a seemingly intractable situation or deeply entrenched habit is met with radical acceptance. Radical acceptance does not mean defining ourselves by our limitations. It is not an excuse for withdrawal. Maybe we tell ourselves, for instance, that we don't have the credentials or experience to suit a job we really want, so we're not even going to apply. Maybe we conclude that, based on our past history, we're not cut out for intimate relationships, and so we're just staying single. While there may be some truth in our assessments, radical acceptance means bringing a clear, kind attention to our capacities and limitations without giving our fear-based stories the power to shut down our lives. The same applies to physical challenges. What if we were to get into a car accident and end up paralyzed from the waist down? If we're told that we may never walk again, does acceptance mean that we hopelessly resign ourselves to our fate? Do we give up on the possibility of having a full and happy life? Radical acceptance wouldn't mean denying our enormous grief about losing the freedom to move on our own. We would fully honor our feelings and responses. We would honestly assess the immediate effect our new limitations would have on our work, our sexuality, our parenting, our household tasks. But radical acceptance also means not overlooking another important truth: the endless creativity and possibility that exist in living. By accepting the truth of change, accepting that we don't know how our life will unfold, we open ourselves to hope so that we can move forward with vitality and will. As so beautifully modeled by actor Christopher Reeve after he was paralyzed in a riding accident, we can throw our full spirit into recovery. We can go for it in physical therapy, in sustaining rich relationships with others, in growing and learning from whatever we experience. In fact, through his efforts, Mr. Reeve has discovered a level of recovery formerly deemed impossible. By meeting our actual experience with the clarity and kindness of radical acceptance, we discover that, whatever our circumstances, we remain free to live creatively, to love fully. Radical acceptance is not self-indulgence. It does not say, I accept that I have this lust or craving, and therefore I'll act on it. While it's important not to deny or suppress our desires, it's also important to be aware of what motivates us and the effects of our behavior. If we are addicted to nicotine, for example, radical acceptance doesn't mean that each time we feel like having a cigarette, we go ahead and light up. Rather, we bring clear seeing and compassion to the craving and tension we feel when we have to have another smoke. We notice the stories that convince us we need a break from the stress we're under. We feel the agitation in our body and taste the memory of tobacco in our mouth. We read the warning label without denying the truth that smoking harms us. If we do have the next cigarette, we don't indulge our justifications or our guilt. We notice them arise and accept them mindfully. Meeting the entire process of smoking with the wakefulness and kindness of radical acceptance can move us toward wiser choices. Radical acceptance does not make us passive. A friend of mine, who is an environmental activist, recently told me if she accepted the degradation of our environment, she would no longer be an active agent for change. An abused woman I saw in therapy told me if she accepted the way her husband was treating her, she would lose her capacity to take care of herself. Students often challenge me. Wouldn't radical acceptance mean accepting Hitler's mass extermination of people? Or simply allowing racism, war, and famine to exist in the world? Does radical acceptance mean we don't respond to suffering in the world? When we feel outrage at human atrocities or despair over the degradation of our environment, we are powerfully and rightfully moved to do something about them. When we see how our own behavior or that of others causes suffering, we are naturally compelled to initiate change. Throughout our lives, these strong responses guide us to pursue spiritual practices and healing therapies, to choose political affiliations, to decide whom we spend time with, what projects to undertake, and how to raise our children. Yet there is a difference between actions and decisions that arise from radical acceptance and those that reflexively spring from our grasping after certain outcomes and our fear of certain consequences. Radical acceptance acknowledges our own experience in this moment as the first step in wise action. Before acting or reacting, we allow ourselves to feel and accept our grief for how the earth has been polluted, our anger about the destruction of wildlife, our shame about how we have been mistreated, our fear about what others may think about us, our guilt about our own insensitivity. No matter what the situation, our immediate personal experience is the fundamental domain of radical acceptance. This is where we cultivate the genuine wakefulness and kindness that underlie effective action. Some of the most revered social activists in the world base their work in radical acceptance. Gandhi in India, Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma, Nelson Mandela in Africa, all underwent the suffering of imprisonment and faced the powerlessness, loneliness, and discomfort of their oppression. With clear comprehension, they saw the potential suffering of angry reactivity and remained mindful of their intention to benefit others. By accepting rather than denying or reacting to their own suffering, they freed themselves to work without bitterness or self-pity for peace and justice. These and many others model the power of placing radical acceptance at the heart of the effort to alleviate suffering. Radical acceptance doesn't mean accepting a self. Sometimes when I talk to students of Buddhism about accepting and loving ourselves, they ask me how this fits with the Buddhist teaching of anatta, or no self. Doesn't the very idea of self-acceptance affirm a mistaken notion of self? As the Buddha taught, our habitual perception of self is a mental construct. The idea of an entity who causes things to happen, who is victimized, who controls the show. When we say, "I accept myself as I am," we are not accepting a story about a good or bad self. Rather, We are accepting the immediate mental and sensory experiences we interpret as self. We are seeing the familiar wants and fears, the judging and planning thoughts as part of the flow of life. Accepting them in this way actually enables us to recognize that experience is impersonal and frees us from the trap of identifying ourselves as a deficient and limited self. I like to remind students that radical is derived from the Latin word radix, meaning going to the root or origin. Radical acceptance enables us to turn to the root or origin of who we are, to the source of our being. When we are unconditionally kind and present, we directly dissolve the trance of unworthiness and separation. In accepting the waves of thought and feeling that arise and pass away, we realize our deepest nature, our original nature, as a boundless sea of wakefulness and love. On the Path of the Buddha, Discovering the Freedom of Radical Acceptance. In contrast to orthodox notions of climbing up a ladder seeking perfection, psychologist Carl Jung describes the spiritual path as an unfolding into wholeness. Rather than trying to vanquish waves of emotion and rid ourselves of an inherently impure self, we turn around and embrace this life in all of its realness, broken, messy, mysterious, and vibrantly alive. By cultivating an unconditional and accepting presence, we are no longer battling against ourselves, keeping our wild and imperfect self in a cage of judgment and mistrust. Instead, we are discovering the freedom of becoming authentic and fully alive. While the acceptance I touched in the desert sanctuary dramatically deepened my trust in myself, integrating this experience was a gradual process. Back in my home ashram on the East Coast, I felt as if I were looking at life through clearer eyes, but it would still take almost 2 years before I would finally be ready to leave. These men, women, and children were my spiritual family. Giving up the community would be a tremendous loss. As I gradually pulled back from my involvement with the ashram, I began to see with increasing clarity how my life there had reinforced my tendencies to climb the ladder of perfection and hide my deficiencies. Also, because now I wasn't doubting or second-guessing myself as much, I could no longer deny the underlying problems in the community I hadn't wanted to confront. My husband had already become disenchanted with life in the ashram, and together we finally agreed it was time to go. When I formally took leave of the teacher, he warned me that if I turned away from him and left this spiritual path, I would be barren for the rest of my life. As fate would have it, within days of announcing our decision and giving up our robes, I got pregnant again. While I anticipated Narayan's birth with great happiness and never questioned our decision to leave, still the pain of so much loss stayed with me for years. Looking back, it makes complete sense that the teachings of the Buddha would guide me through this wrenching transition. As I felt myself withdrawing from the ashram, I had begun reading books about other spiritual traditions. I felt particularly drawn to Buddhism and began to experiment with a Buddhist mindfulness meditation called Vipassana, which means to see clearly, in Pali, the language of the Buddha. It is a practice based on teachings that explicitly acknowledged the suffering I was feeling and offered a way to awaken from it. In the ashram, our meditation had been geared toward cultivating a state of peacefulness, energy, or rapture. We would quiet the mind by concentrating on the breath or a sacred Sanskrit phrase. It was a valuable training, but I found that when I was in emotional turmoil, these meditations at best only temporarily covered over my distress. I was manipulating my inner experience rather than being with what was actually happening. The Buddhist mindfulness practices, on the other hand, taught me to simply open and allow the changing stream of experience to move through me. When a harsh self-judgment appeared, I could recognize it simply as a passing thought. It might be a tenacious and regular visitor, but realizing it wasn't truth was wonderfully liberating. When I got lost in feelings of insecurity or loneliness, I found that the loving kindness and compassion meditations could guide me back to that tenderness I had felt in the desert sanctuary. I was no longer striving to rid myself of pain. Rather, I was learning to relate to the suffering I felt with care. From the very start, these practices carried me to a loving, open, and accepting awareness that felt like my true nature. After several years of meditating on my own, I attended my first silent retreat at the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. I knew I had come home. At the end of one of the evening talks, something the teacher said struck me profoundly. It addressed the core suffering I had been struggling with for so long. The words I remember were, "The boundary to what we can accept is the boundary to our freedom." During the silence that followed, memories flashed through my mind, revealing how much of my life experience I had been defended against. I could feel the walls I had erected to keep out those people who were different from me, those who intimidated me or demanded too much from me. I recognized my aversion to physical discomfort, to feeling fear and loneliness. I realized how unforgiving I felt toward myself for hurting others, for being judging, obsessive, selfish. When the teacher and most of the students left the hall, I remained in the quiet and stillness. I wanted to know what it would be like if all boundaries dissolved and I just let life live through me. As I relaxed open, my heart and mind filled with tenderness toward everything that felt so painful in me and seemed so wrong. I realized that any argument I had with life, from a slight self-criticism to the utter anguish of shame, separated me from the love and awareness that are my true home. Many times since then, especially when I've been caught up in tension or self-judgment, I have stopped and asked myself, what would it be like if I could accept life, accept this moment, exactly as it is? Regardless of which particular mental movie has been playing, just the intention to accept my experience begins to deepen my attention and softens my heart. As I grow more intimate with the actual waves of experience moving through me, the running commentary in my mind releases its grip, and the tension in my body begins to dissolve. Each time I begin again, wakefully allowing life to be as it is, I experience that vivid sense of arriving, of re-entering the changing flow of experience. This letting be is the gateway to being filled with wonder and fully alive. As the author Storm Jameson puts it, there is only one world, the world pressing against you at this minute. There is only one minute in which you are alive, this minute, here and now. The only way to live is by accepting each minute as an unrepeatable miracle. We are all capable of learning radical acceptance. The two wings of clear recognition and compassionate presence are expressions of who we intrinsically are. Yet because we quite naturally get lost in trance, we need both a sincere resolve and effective practices in order to awaken our heart and mind. The teachings and meditations offered in this book belong to a rich spiritual heritage that has, for centuries, guided those who seek genuine peace and freedom. On this sacred path of radical acceptance, rather than striving for perfection, we discover how to love ourselves into wholeness. Guided meditation, the practice of vipassana, mindfulness. The Buddhist practice for developing mindfulness is called vipassana, which means to see clearly or insight in Pali, the language of the Buddha. What follows is a simple introduction to this practice. You might listen to it several times until it becomes familiar. Find a sitting position that allows you to be alert, spine erect but not rigid, and also relaxed. Close your eyes and rest your hands in an easy, effortless way. Allow your awareness to scan through your body, and wherever possible, soften and release obvious areas of physical tension. Because we so easily get lost in thoughts, Vipassana begins with attention to the breath. Using the breath as a primary anchor of mindfulness helps quiet the mind so that you can be aware to the changing stream of life that moves through you. Take a few very full breaths, and then allow your breath to be natural. Notice where you most easily detect the breath. You might feel it as it flows in and out of your nose. You might feel the touch of the breath around your nostrils or on your upper lip. Or perhaps you feel the movement of your chest or the rising and falling of your abdomen. Bring your attention to the sensations of breathing in one of these areas, perhaps where you feel them most distinctly. There is no need to control the breath, to grasp or fixate on it. There is no right way of breathing. With a relaxed awareness, discover what the breath is really like as a changing experience of sensations. You will find that the mind naturally drifts off in thoughts. Thoughts are not the enemy, and you do not need to clear your mind of thoughts. Rather, you are developing the capacity to recognize when thoughts are happening without getting lost in the storyline. When you become aware of thinking, you might use a soft and friendly mental note. Thinking, thinking. Then, without any judgment, gently return to the immediacy of the breath. Let the breath be home base, a place full of presence. While you might notice other experiences, the sounds of passing cars, feelings of being warm or cool, sensations of hunger, they can be in the background without drawing you away. If any particular sensations become strong and call your attention, allow those sensations instead of the breath to become the primary subject of mindfulness. You might feel heat or chills, tingling, aching, twisting, stabbing, vibrating. With a soft, open awareness, just feel the sensations as they are. Are they pleasant or unpleasant? As you fully attend to them, do they become more intense or dissipate? Notice how they change. When the sensations are no longer a strong experience, return to mindfulness of breathing. Or if the sensations are so unpleasant that you are unable to regard them with any balance or equanimity, feel free to rest your attention again in the breath. In a similar way, you can bring mindfulness to strong emotions, fear, sadness, happiness, excitement, grief. Meet each experience with a kind and clear presence, neither clinging to nor resisting what is happening. What does this emotion feel like as sensations in your body? Where do you feel it most strongly? Is it static or moving? How big is it? Are your thoughts agitated and vivid? Are they repetitive and dull? Does your mind feel contracted or open? As you pay attention, notice how the emotion changes. Does it become more intense or weaken? Does it change into a different state? Anger to grief, happiness to peace? When the emotion is no longer compelling, turn your attention back to the breath. If the emotion feels overwhelming for you, or if you are confused about where to place your attention, relax and come home to your breath. The particular sensations, emotions, or thoughts that arise when we practice mindfulness are not so important. It is our willingness to become still and pay attention to our experience, whatever it may be, that plants the seeds of radical acceptance. With time, we develop the capacity to relate to our passing experience, whether in meditation or daily life, with deep clarity and kindness. 3. The sacred pause, resting under the Bodhi tree. Enough. These few words are enough. If not these words, this breath. If not this breath, this sitting here. This opening to the life, we have refused again and again until now. Until now. David White. In the 1950s, a few highly trained pilots in the U.S. Air Force were set a life-or-death task: to fly at altitudes higher than ever before attempted. Going beyond the Earth's denser atmosphere, they found, much to their horror, that the ordinary laws of aerodynamics no longer existed. As Tom Wolfe describes it in The Right Stuff, a plane could skid into a flat spin like a cereal bowl on a waxed Formica counter, and then start tumbling, not spinning and diving, but tumbling end over end. The first pilots to face this challenge responded by frantically trying to stabilize their planes, applying correction after correction. The more furiously they manipulated the controls, the wilder the ride became. Screaming helplessly to ground control, "What do I do next?" they would plunge to their deaths. This tragic drama occurred several times until one of the pilots, Chuck Yeager, inadvertently struck upon a solution. When his plane began tumbling, Yeager was thrown violently around the cockpit and knocked out. Unconscious, he plummeted toward Earth. 7 miles later, the plane re-entered the planet's denser atmosphere, where standard navigation strategies could be implemented. Yeager came to, steadied the craft, and landed safely. He had discovered the only life-saving response that was possible in this desperate situation. Don't do anything. You take your hands off the controls. This solution, as Wolf puts it, was the only choice you had. It countered all training and even basic survival instincts, but it worked. In our lives, we often find ourselves in situations we can't control, circumstances in which none of our strategies work. Helpless and distraught, we frantically try to manage what is happening. Our child takes a downward turn in academics, and we issue one threat after another to get him in line. Someone says something hurtful to us, and we strike back quickly or retreat. We make a mistake at work, and we scramble to cover it up or go out of our way to make up for it. We head into emotionally charged confrontations, nervously rehearsing and strategizing. The more we fear failure, the more frenetically our bodies and minds work. We fill our days with continual movement, mental planning and worrying, habitual talking, fixing, scratching, adjusting, phoning, snacking, discarding, buying, looking in the mirror. What would it be like if, right in the midst of this busyness, we were to consciously take our hands off the controls? Chuck Yeager had to go unconscious to interrupt the compulsion to control. What if we were to intentionally stop our mental computations and our rushing around, and for a minute or two, simply pause and notice our inner experience? Learning to pause is the first step in the practice of radical acceptance. A pause is a suspension of activity, a time of temporary disengagement, when we are no longer moving toward any goal. Unlike the frantic pilots, we stop asking, "What do I do next?" The pause can occur in the midst of almost any activity, and can last for an instant, for hours, or for seasons of our life. We may take a pause from our ongoing responsibilities by sitting down to meditate. We may pause in the midst of meditation to let go of thoughts and reawaken our attention to the breath. We may pause by stepping out of daily life to go on a retreat, or to spend time in nature, or to take a sabbatical. We may pause in a conversation, letting go of what we're about to say, in order to genuinely listen and be with the other person. We may pause when we feel suddenly moved, or delighted, or saddened, allowing the feelings to play through our heart. In a pause, we simply discontinue whatever we are doing thinking, talking, walking, writing, planning, worrying, eating, and become wholeheartedly present, attentive, and often physically still. You might try it now. Pause the audiobook and sit there, doing nothing, and simply notice what you are experiencing. A pause is, by nature, time-limited. We resume our activities, but we do so with increased presence and more ability to make choices. In the pause before sinking our teeth into a chocolate bar, for instance, we might recognize the excited tingle of anticipation, and perhaps a background cloud of guilt and self-judgment. We may then choose to eat the chocolate, fully savoring the taste sensations, or we might decide to skip the chocolate and instead go out for a run. When we pause, we don't know what will happen next. But by disrupting our habitual behaviors, we open to the possibility of new and creative ways of responding to our wants and fears. Of course, there are times when it is not appropriate to pause. If our child is running toward a busy street, we don't pause. If someone is about to strike us, we don't just stand there, resting in the moment. Rather, we quickly find a way to defend ourselves. If we are about to miss a flight, we race toward the gate. But much of our driven pace and habitual controlling in daily life does not serve surviving, and certainly not thriving. It arises from a free-floating anxiety about something being wrong or not enough. Even when our fear arises in the face of actual failure, loss, or, like the military pilots, death, our instinctive tensing and striving are often ineffectual and unwise. Taking our hands off the controls and pausing is an opportunity to clearly see the wants and fears that are driving us. During the moments of a pause, we become conscious of how the feeling that something is missing or wrong keeps us leaning into the future, on our way to somewhere else. This gives us a fundamental choice in how we respond. We can continue our futile attempts at managing our experience, or we can meet our vulnerability with the wisdom of radical acceptance. During my pause in the desert sanctuary, I began to see how utterly stuck I was in the stories and suffering of trance. By staying put and not occupying myself with other activities, I faced the shame and fears that I had been running from for years. In fact, pausing and accepting the intensity of my suffering was the only way I could have released the grip of trance. Often the moment when we most need to pause is exactly when it feels most intolerable to do so. Pausing in a fit of anger, or when overwhelmed by sorrow or filled with desire, may be the last thing we want to do. Like the high-altitude pilots, letting go of the controls seems to run counter to our basic and instinctual ways of getting what we want. Pausing can feel like falling helplessly through space. We have no idea of what will happen. We fear we might be engulfed by the rawness of our rage or grief or desire. Yet without opening to the actual experience of the moment, radical acceptance is not possible. Charlotte Jocko Beck, Zen teacher and author, teaches that the secret of spiritual life is the capacity to return to that which we have spent a lifetime hiding from, to rest in the bodily experience of the present moment, even if it is a feeling of being humiliated, of failing, of abandonment, of unfairness. Through the sacred art of pausing, we develop the capacity to stop hiding, to stop running away from our experience. We begin to trust in our natural intelligence, in our naturally wise heart, in our capacity to open to whatever arises. Like awakening from a dream, in the moment of pausing, our trance recedes, and radical acceptance becomes possible. Running away deepens the trance. A traditional folktale tells the story of a man who becomes so frightened by his own shadow that he tries to run away from it. He believes that if only he could leave it behind, he would then be happy. The man grows increasingly distressed as he sees that no matter how fast he runs, his shadow never once falls behind. Not about to give up, he runs faster and faster until he finally drops